Welcome to the Jack of No Trades podcast. I'm Michelle McAllister, and this is a podcast about people and what they do. In this episode, I sat down with Karen Goldstein, who is a criminal defense attorney based out of Los Angeles. We discuss what prompted her to start her own practice, the current climate of the criminal justice system, and the importance of mentorship. Karen is a close friend of the podcast, but this is the first time I got the chance to drill her about a profession. So a big thank you to Karen for sitting down with me. And now, here's my interview with Karen Goldstein. Go for it.
So I'm Karen Goldstein. I am a criminal defense attorney. I have a private practice. I also do indigent defense work, which means I represent people accused of crimes who cannot afford their own defense. And I've had my own law firm since 2007. And I practice mainly in Los Angeles, but I'm licensed also in D.C. and New York.
Were you always licensed in D.C. and New York?
No, that is new additions to the repertoire. That's me wanting to expand the Karen Goldstein brand.
Because you don't work enough.
I don't, clearly. Not 7 days a week, not weekends, never.
No. So when you were a little kid and you envisioned yourself as an adult, what did you think you were going to be?
I thought I was going to be very melodramatic, whatever I did.
Well, in that case, you were totally on
success. I was very. I liked theater a lot. I was a theater kid. I was kind of a nerdy theater kid, and I had a flair for the dramatic. However, I was also very into social justice issues, maybe more on a little kid level. And I did not envision myself as a criminal defense lawyer, though. That wasn't a thing in my brain. However, the idea of combining theater and maybe being some kind of litigator or trial lawyer was, I did envision that pretty early on.
As a kid, what were the social justice issues that you were thinking of? I'm just curious.
So when I was younger, I was very animal rights. And it's kind of ironic because I definitely wear leather. I love leather. All Saints is one of my favorite leather jackets ever. So it's a little
bit. All Saints is not being paid for.
Yeah, sorry about that. But it's just true. I find it a little bit hypocritical now. But early on in life, I didn't eat meat and I still don't eat meat. And I was very into animal rights. Not that I wasn't into human rights, but that was just something early I latched on to.
It's easier to like animals more than humans.
Yeah, okay. It is. I mean, hell is other people. A little Sartre there for you. But so that was something kind of that I latched onto early on. And then I like arguing too. And I like playing devil's advocate, which is something that happened early on. So if there was something, for example, my parents wanted to argue for, I loved challenging them to argue against whatever the issue was. It was natural for me.
Who did you get that from?
Definitely from my dad. My dad is also an attorney. But he's a civil lawyer. He's not conservative. He's also a Democrat. But, if he would say that he was for the death penalty, which, by the way, just in case dad ever hears this, he's not, that I know of. But then I would make the counter arguments as to why I would be against it. So I liked being contrarian. I like to argue. And I also like being, fighting for the underdog. That's something that I always found really compelling to me. And maybe it's because I myself was not one of those popular girls. Like, I was the weird theater kid. And so I was just, like, preserving my own self-interest as the underdog. But I kind of liked always rooting for the underdog. I think I've always been kind of polarizing, too. Now, I'm not for everybody. I'm definitely an acquired taste. And sometimes you have to acquire the taste many times before you like it. But, some people get there, some people don't. I definitely had always my own circle of friends, but it wasn't like for mass consumption, really. And so I think that's just typical of people that do theater and are creative types. But I was nerdy, too, and brainy. And so I knew I kind of did want to be an actress for a few years of my life. But then I realized I wanted to use that in a different context. And, I feel fortunate that I grew up really not wanting for anything. I went to an amazing boarding school that really opened my mind and challenged me academically. And because of that, I think it opened me up to certain social justice issues for people that don't have what I have, and I met people from a lot of different backgrounds at that boarding school, different countries, but also different socioeconomic places than where I came from. And it kind of gave me, I guess, the momentum and an interest in combining sort of the flair for the dramatic with something that might actually help people in life.
And you started out in on the East Coast, and then you came over here. What was it that made you come over to California?
Oh, I was always such a New York neurotic Jew. And it's like, I feel like I fit every funny stereotype. I come from four generations of neurotic New York Jews, and I was just so uptight and OCD about everything. And I had this vision that if I just moved to the West Coast, that I would be a little more relaxed, and I'd kind of enjoy my life more. And as it turns out, when I moved here, I basically am just a New York neurotic Jew on the West Coast now. But my brother is a filmmaker and director, and he was in Los Angeles. So that gave me the idea that maybe this could be a good change of pace. I was just sort of over myself. I was over my neuroses. I was over the type A. But frankly, not much has changed except it's 90 degrees in November, and I'm here, and I'm still working on weekends. So, you know.
But tell me, for people who don't know, what is the day in the life of a defense attorney?
Ah, well, a lot of jail and a lot of court and a lot of unexpected happenings. So, of course, there's literally not a typical day. But I do spend a lot of my time in court hearings. If it's federal court, that's very formal. You have to address the judges with your honor. It's incredibly formal. State court is a little more wild, wild west, as I call it, just because, I don't know, it's evolved that way in California that it's a little more informal. And jail is like a whole nother ballgame. But if you do what I do, even if you're taking private cases and even if your clients have money to afford you, at some point your client's going to end up in jail. Like, it's inevitable that you're going to have a case where bond is too high even for a very well-off client. To be out of custody. And so I spend a lot of my time doing visits in the county jails and the federal jails, and then sometimes post-conviction in prisons. But frankly, a lot of my day is also spent just putting out fires in cases. You know, prosecutors filing unexpected motions that you have to respond to in a time-sensitive way. Clients calling you hysterically saying, oops, I might have fucked up, which is not something you want to hear your client say in my context, because often that means I just did something and I'm about to get arrested. I'm about to lose my bond. I might have killed somebody. You don't know. But putting out fires is a huge part of my daily life as well. The only thing you can really expect is sort of the unexpected, because sometimes you get text messages that you just can't make the shit up, like the things that your clients have done accidentally, intentionally, or have been accused of.
Do you think that people who, when they're out on bond, do you think some of that is paranoia, or sometimes it's like, nah, you really fucked up?
It's definitely a combination. I've had some people, understandably, particularly if, you know, you have a history of not trusting law enforcement, which frankly, I would say brown and black populations and any minority populations rightfully should not trust law enforcement. So some of those communities, I'd say, of clients are a little, you know, paranoid. And sometimes it's not justified, but it's based on historical context of you know, that community being discriminated against. Other times, truthfully, my clients have fucked up on bond, and you can lose your bond and go to jail. And then also, if you've put up your house, for example, for bond, then you might lose your house, or if you put up your mother's house, which happens too. So, you know, I've definitely had clients, unfortunately, that have had issues, like while they're being supervised, you know, they go somewhere they're not supposed to, they're on electronic monitoring, the ankle bracelet goes off, they lose their bond. And then they're the ones where you just know your client's a bit neurotic, high maintenance. Again, eccentric. Understand that. Is it what?
Eccentric.
Eccentric, that's a nice way of putting it. Sure, idiosyncratic, we could say, if you want to get, you know, nice and diplomatic about it. Or pain in the ass is another way of putting it. Some clients are just a pain in the ass and call you hysterically about things that there's no need to be hysterical over. But frankly, I do get a lot of panicked calls that they really should be panicked because there's a warrant out for their arrest, or, you know, they have good reason to panic.
Well, what is it about your field that excites you?
Well, there is never a dull moment, but the truth is this storytelling element. I kind of see people on what I imagine to be one of the worst days of their life, if not the worst day. And I really believe in second chances and redemption. Like, you can't do what I do and not, or let me put it this way, I'm going to be judgy and say you shouldn't do what I do if you don't believe in that. And so I love being able, or being charged with, telling that person's story. And you have to be persuasive, right, about it, to a jury, to a judge, to a prosecutor, and giving them that second chance. And I tell my clients, I'm like, I'm going to give you and fight for that second chance, and then it's yours, and if you fuck it up, that's it. But I really believe in that. And the truth is, it sounds like a hokey expression, but I believe it. good people make bad decisions a lot. And it's so to me, it's exciting. I don't know if exciting is the right word, because I'm kind of getting people out of really tough situations. But it makes it compelling emotionally to me. And then also because I do indigent defense work, in those cases in particular, I know I'm helping communities that never got a chance in the past, you know, and I'm trying to equalize the playing field a little. So I don't know if exciting is the right word, but it keeps my heart happy. It makes me feel like I'm making a difference. And in particular, those cases are really rewarding when they turn out well.
We see a lot of depictions of the criminal justice system in TV and in media. What do you think they get right and what do you think they get wrong?
Well, I understand that they have to sensationalize a bit to keep it interesting. And also, like, in the process, they have to shorten it because you just can't have how long it really takes to prep a jury trial. But I always laugh when it's like, here's the arraignment, which is where somebody pleads not guilty on the charges. And then the trial is like 10 days later or something. Hell no. My serious felony trials take a year to prepare at least. So that is funny. But I understand that's more of a... This is just sort of to try to fit it into like a TV series or movie. But I think the thing that's actually significant that they consistently get wrong, which I personally am offended by, is the way they depict defense attorneys. It's shocking. We're always like, it tends to be men, right? But they're in like the crappy, frumpled, wrinkled clothing. They're not prepared. They're like consistently like fumbling around with papers. And then very often they're sitting next to their client who's like confessing to a law enforcement officer and they're just like letting the person talk. I'm like, what kind of role do you think defense attorneys play? You would be fired, or even a public defender wouldn't do that. I find it really shocking that there seems to be this stereotype that defense attorneys are incompetent and kind of weak-minded and, you know, just like frumpled and bumbling. Like, definitely not in my world. I mean, of course, they're bad lawyers everywhere. That seems pretty consistent. Like, even in shows like Law and Order, I've seen that stereotype portrayed. I'm trying to think of things they get right. I mean...
You gotta think. Deep.
I do. I'm like... I think, you know, it obviously depends on the movie or the TV show. Like when they have legal consultants, it always is a bit juicier. I would say there's some times when cross-examination is done pretty well. But let me give you an example of when it's not, because, you know, I think everybody knows the "you can't handle the truth" cross-examination moment from A Few Good Men. That shit never happens. I'm sorry. I feel like I am fairly decent at cross-examination, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But it's not like in your typical trial, a witness just breaks down on the stand and gives you everything you've ever hoped for. Like, that is so unrealistic. Has it happened? Sure. Does it happen often? Absolutely not. Like, that moment is brilliant when it does, and I'm just, like, patting myself on the back. But, you know, it's more like a defense attorney, I think of as getting these tiny little nuggets from the cross-examination that you then argue and incorporate into your story in closing when you're talking to the jury. Though you just have to get like a checklist of little things. So I think to make it fun, they sensationalize these moments where like a witness just breaks down and the truth comes out, whatever that means. That's not really how trials work. But of course, if you've seen things like The Making of a Murderer, which are two lawyers that I've met who I think are phenomenal lawyers, that kind of follows them through the process. That, of course, is more accurate because you're getting footage, into – and that actually is a fantastic, I think, view of how hard defense attorneys can fight when they're passionate for their clients. I was really moved by that. And there are some really chilling scenes there too, like one of the juvenile clients confesses on videotape with – what's supposed to be a defense investigator. But I think like those kind of shows, thankfully, in the last couple of years, have started to combat that narrative of the incompetent defense attorney. And maybe, or probably, I'm overly sensitive to that, but I feel like that used to be all you saw in Law and Order, for example.
Don't forget, usually I think from what I've seen of defense attorneys, they usually have some sort of really hindering impairment, like they're an alcoholic just some sort of like, or they're, you know, they're living out of their car, or it's just something that's like, it, these people are clearly like they're barely hanging on to the norms of society and the trappings of society in some way or another. I'm like, wow, that's, I mean, it would be impressive to be able to go into court after that, but I don't think I could.
I don't know how comfortable that client would feel if you yourself were, yeah, living out of your car, your law practice is out of your car. It doesn't inspire a ton of confidence. But I mean, I will say that, you know, I do think the public generally has a very negative view of defense attorneys. So that depiction in cinema and TV doesn't come out of nowhere. Like, I think people think of us as the, you know, scum of the earth, frankly, like low life, the lowest on the chain of like lawyers for what we do. We defend guilty people. We put criminals on the streets. You know, I've heard all that crap before. Not new to me. And I do think that, you know, blends into how media depicts us. But thankfully, absolutely. I also feel like things have changed a bit over the past few years.
Do you think like the recent interest in some of these high profile trials has to change perception of defense attorneys, or do you think it hasn't made an impact?
No, I think it's helped introduce more nuance, I think, into how jurors see the criminal justice system. So for example, you do in voir dire. And no, please, voir dire, if anybody ever says that, I'm going to smack them. First of all, it's French. Second of all, why would you ever see that, okay? But that is the question. That's the process by which you question jurors. And when people say voir dire because I speak French, I lose my mind.
French 101 brought to you by Karen Goldstein.
That's correct. It gives you some context and things to question jurors about that remind them of the other side of the coin, the flip side of the coin where defense attorneys are fighting for potentially innocent clients. So like having context, being able to refer to some high profile cases or the making of a murderer, for example, in voir dire, like, have you seen it? What did you think about that? How did you think about the defense attorneys and how they were depicted? It's introduced a little more nuance for me, and it gives me a reference point so I can kind of tell where the jurors' biases are. And I do think it's been really helpful. I mean, I don't think you can really undo it. There's so much social media presence about criminal justice issues. There is so much true crime now. But in my mind, it's very helpful. And frankly, the Black Lives Matter movement has been really helpful. It really has put a spotlight on issues criminal defense attorneys have known about for years in terms of how law enforcement specifically behaves really badly, violently, unconstitutionally. And I think a lot of times people just chalked it up to me being very liberal. Obviously, I am. And just being like passionate about my profession. But now it gives that like air of corroboration and objectivity because people are filming police encounters. People are talking about it. People are protesting. So I think all of that, I don't think it's ever going to make my job easy. But at least it makes it more nuanced when I have a conversation or try to during voir dire with my jury about you know, where their biases might be.
I think, if anything, it really has pointed out that everybody has bias. Any contention in my mind where people are like, we're completely unbiased or we're completely objective, the opposite of subjective.
Correct.
I that always raises a red flag in my mind whenever someone claims that because...
Oh, yeah, that's a lie. If somebody says that in my jury pool, I'm like, this person's out. Because clearly... they have a secret agenda. They want to be on that jury. It's very clear to me. If you say, I am just totally open-minded and impartial, that's not human nature. And I say that. I'll try to say that. Like, look, we literally all see life through our own lens. Like, we see life how we've been raised, and we have our own kind of biases. And I try to ask, like, sometimes this works, sometimes it doesn't, sort of a theoretical question. Like, if you were the defendant sitting in that seat charged of a heinous crime, and you looked out to the jury and a person there had lived with your life experiences, your views, your emotions, like would you want you as your own juror? And it's a really weird philosophical question. And sometimes I phrase that a lot better than I just did today. But the idea is knowing what you know about how you've been raised and the things, you know, the experiences that you know that you cannot tune out in your life. Do you think you could give somebody a fair trial? And, you know, honestly, the answer is no in a lot of cases, especially I do a lot of really serious cases that involve, you know, gang RICO conspiracy or sexual assault cases. And people have very deeply rooted beliefs about these kinds of things. So, but point being, if a juror raises their hand and is like, I'm good, I'm open, I'm perfect, they're out in my mind. Unless I really believe it, but I'm inclined to believe there's an agenda there.
Do you, I mean, I know that you tend to work with RICO and drug offenses. Would you say that is your quote unquote expertise or your main type of case, or do you think it runs the gamut?
It definitely runs the gamut. But I would say if you ask, like, reputationally what people know me for, there's sort of two areas and they're very different. in state court, actually would be state or federal, but these just tend to be charged more in state, it would definitely be false accusations of sexual assault of all kind. And that would involve anything from child pornography and child molestation to rape. And in federal court, it would be more like child pornography, just because that's more often charged. But then in federal court, over the past couple of years, I've really been litigating a lot of gang RICO conspiracy cases, which do involve drug charges, always, not always, but often. So two kind of different areas of the law. However, I've done and have experience in pretty much everything from the smallest misdemeanor of petty theft or like an infraction disturbing the peace up to I'm doing capital work now, so death penalty work. And those are different kinds of cases as well. So for sure, I actually have a background in a wide range of offenses, but just the ones I've been going to trial on lately tend to fall into the RICO gang conspiracy type cases or sexual assault cases.
You were just awarded in 2020 the Trial Attorney of the Year for Los Angeles, right?
Yes, the Criminal Courts Bar Association, which is an organization that has criminal justice members. So it's prosecutors and judges and defense lawyers for Los Angeles.
Describe the prestige for those who are not familiar.
Well, this is an organization since I was a young baby lawyer that I went to. And I always said it was like a combination of our prom and our awards, you know, the kind of like our Oscars, but then also our prom because everyone likes to get dressed up and it's black tie. And I remember going after one of my first trials ever and like meeting judges and just being sort of in awe and inspired by like everybody in the room around me. And I have very clear memories of one of the first times. So that would have been like, oh God, what year was that? Like 2007, 2000. I graduated from law school in 2003, and I had 3 years at a private firm before I started my own. But I think my first memory of the Criminal Courts Bar Association is around 2006 or 7. So I was still a baby lawyer. And definitely thinking in the back of my head, you know, and remembering the people being honored at this dinner because it's a formal dinner, awards are given out, everyone's kind of dressed up and there's speeches. And I remember thinking in the back of my head, this is what I want. But I was thinking, this is what I want, and this is, you know, what I want to work up to and be inspired by probably when I am a bit older, like in my 50s. Not to say I'm not old. It's all relative. Okay?
Not old.
But that's what I remember thinking of in the back of my head. So the fact that this was an award I was given, although technically the ceremony hasn't happened yet because of COVID, in 2020 for my work in 2019 – was the hugest honor I can imagine. Like it's you know, I was really shocked and also appreciative, grateful. It definitely takes a village, that's what I'll say, because I feel like I've had a lot of great mentors along the way. And just being one of the only women, I believe I'm the fifth woman ever to win this, and being younger was a huge honor for me. And I hope I can pave the way for others because, frankly, it's still an old white man universe where I live. And this was a big deal for that reason, too.
You talk about mentorship, and mentorship is pretty important when it comes to career development and getting to the next rung. Especially for women, it's a little bit traditionally more difficult. How did you obtain the mentors that you have? And how do you reach out and find people that you can mentor and help to give back?
I think it's very tough, women with women. I'm sure you would agree, probably in every industry, but like the women who are just the generation, I would say, older than me, one generation older, really had insane levels of discrimination to get where they are. And so I feel like that, and I'm making broad sweeping generalizations here, it was hard to be mentored by that generation of women. I feel like even when I encounter them today in court, they're sort of like, well, I made it. You need to figure it out. And I do think there wasn't a lot of helpful, like trying to help one another. Because of that, I latched on to the few people I could. A lot of them, frankly, were men. And a lot of them, their mentoring style was, well, you learn by doing. Here's your first jury trial. It's a gang murder case. Good luck.
Harsh. So get in that pool and swim. Okay.
So, but, you know, I would say a few years later, after like my very first, I did find one person in particular. I'll do a shout out, Deborah White. But she's also one of my closest friends now. But she is one who like kind of just showed me some basic things, like in criminal defense, there's like, we call this something the Bible that she gave me, and just gave me basic techniques and then encouraged me, frankly, to go out on my own and start my own law firm practice, which I did because she had. And that's also pretty rare. So like, and then there's another female I found much later in life who kind of introduced me to federal practice more and honed my skills there. And so they're few and far between, but absolutely crucial for me.
You talked about going out on your own in the beginning. How did you get your start? Because that can be kind of daunting, I think, to anybody when they're starting a new endeavor. And how have you kept that going so many years?
Oh, yeah. Private practice is its own unique animal. So I don't think I knew what I was getting into when I did it, but I was very adventurous, I guess, a little more adventuresome when I was in my late 20s. And I just said, I can do this. I can do it better and more ethically, frankly, than my boss. And so I had a male boss, and I'll tell you what the turning point was. And it's very sexist, and I think it says a lot about the time I used to be in and the headspace I was in and where we are now. And it's not perfect for female defense lawyers, but it's better. So I was doing a trial, and it was a murder trial. It was an attempted murder trial, and I was co-counseling. So I was sharing the trial with my boss, who was male and 20 years my senior. And he insisted that for this trial, and I was not married at the time, I had to wear a fake wedding ring because he was concerned that the jury would be focused on the fact that we might be sleeping together. I can assure you the only person who would ever think we would be sleeping together would be him. He was literally 20 years my senior, okay?
And even if in some universe that was going on, why would a wedding ring stop that?
None of it makes sense. It was all very offensive. I literally had to go. He's my boss. I literally went and bought a fake wedding ring for the trial. Clearly, the jury's not focused on this anyway. Why would they be? Why would they be? This is just like narcissism at its peak. But this was the attitude. I was told not to wear skirt suits in court. Or if I did, they could not be too short. So after that experience, which we had a good result, but we fought over how to do the closing argument. And based on a juror question that was asked, he was wrong. He was just wrong. And my instincts were much better on that particular case, even though the result was good. But I made the decision to leave after that. I was like, I am not doing this. I'm not playing these sexist games. That's ridiculous. And I didn't like all of the ethics. That was just a small example. So I went on to my own after. And honestly, it basically was an opportunity that came from an outside source with somebody saying, look, I know you work for this law firm, but I have a friend who needs help. Could you talk to him? I said, sure. It was literally like, I remember, he's like, I can put down $5,000. And keep in mind, this is not a responsible business model, which is why I'm telling you. He's like, that wasn't the full retainer fee, but that's what I can do right now to hire you. And I'm like, all right, I'm going out on my own. Here we go. And I did. And I gave my notice. You know, I didn't burn any bridges. I didn't give any reasons. I didn't tell him that was why I was leaving. But I gave my notice. I made sure I wrapped up all my cases. I let all my clients know that I was leaving. And then anybody that, you know, was interested down the road, some people did contact me later when I was on my own. And I never looked back. But I have to say that Deborah White, who, like I said, is one of my mentors, she had gone out on her own before. And she told me, like, you can do this. And you can do it. And you can support yourself financially. And you can do this more ethically than the way the firm is running things here, which is where we had met. And so I kind of took a risk on one little case with one little client. And from there, it just built. But I will say this, they do not teach you how to be a good business person in law school. You don't learn that. And I still feel like I'm learning that. And it's hard because I want to help people. And my heart takes me one place and the purse strings takes you somewhere else. And you have to figure out how to reconcile those two things. And it's still not that easy for me. I really think I'm much better at being a lawyer than I am at being a businesswoman, but I've learned over the years. And I still think I, you know, am bad at delegating responsibility and you know, working kind of, I'm still, I guess, balancing how to work with paralegals and other attorneys and all of that. But it's the best move I ever made. I might work very long hours, but you reap what you sow. I get to pick the kind of cases other than my indigent defense cases, which are appointed. And, you know, it's rewarding because it's my own name. It's also more stressful because it's your reputation and, you know, everything you do is going to make or break that. But it feels so much more rewarding than doing that for somebody else who you don't think is ethical.
These days, everything is much more polarizing than it, I would say, 10 years ago. have you witnessed that in what you do for a living, as far as hearing opposing viewpoints, other people opposing viewpoints for what you do? Has it become more challenging in that way, to get people just to hear a meeting point, even if, you know, it's not even the end result of what you're of the verdict? Maybe it's something in the middle.
I definitely think the Me Too movement has made, as a really good example, has made things really hard in the realm of defending sexual assault allegations. I think people can be offended that I'm a woman representing people accused of committing these heinous sex crimes. I also think I'm so liberal that people sometimes are offended by my perspective on accusations of sex crimes, because I think we've lost nuance in our conversation. I am absolutely not anti-victim, my God. I mean, just because you're a defense attorney doesn't mean you don't believe victims when they're real victims. It means you want to have a critical eye towards what actually happened and make sure what you're dealing with is a victim. So I think it is polarizing in the media based on a lot of the movements we've had. And one is, you know, is the Me Too movement and the Time's Up movement, and then the other being Black Lives Matter. But the Me Too is the one that I think has made particularly the kind of cases I tend to defend even more challenging. And also people just seem to be so offended sometimes when I talk about my cases, because I don't think it's the same thing. I'm not saying it's right, but to me, it's not the same making inappropriate sexual marks in the workplace, which is not okay, but that's not the same as rape or sexual assault of any kind. And I do think, unfortunately, now there's so much in the media, we've sort of lost like where we are in the spectrum and what the nuance can mean. And I think that's important. It's important for punishment. It's important for the legal system to have more complicated and nuanced conversations. And so I'm really glad we have shown a spotlight on this. Obviously, I just told you a story where essentially that was a form of sexual harassment in some way. And
absolutely.
And I've experienced a lot of other stuff in my career way beyond that. But I think these movements have polarized the public, and it makes the conversation harder. Again, a lot of times when I'm picking a jury, to get a fair jury.
Speaking of selections of juries, do you have a set procedure that you do for every single case as far as your jury selection, or does that tailor to the case at hand?
I really wish I did, man.
Does that take a lot of time?
Yeah, it does. And it's like, if you don't pick an open-minded jury, you have lost the case before you start. Mm-hmm. So it's probably the most important part of the case. And I think I'm really weak at it sometimes. I think my instincts are good, but sometimes we're not given the time we need to question. The answer is I honestly don't. I feel like I'm still growing in this. But I have sort of... I'm very organized, and I like to have this little note card system where I have little notes on the juries, the jury pool, that I can kind of move around in this little clear plastic binder. But the problem is each court does it a bit differently. So sometimes it's a pool of 30, sometimes it's a pool of 100. Sometimes they call them an 18-pack or a 12-pack, and so it kind of messes up my little organized card system, which makes me feel flustered, and then I don't do as good a job. So I'm still working out the actual system, but in terms of the questions I ask, that is really case specific. Okay, so there's some general things you can always ask, like the things about your biases. If you were the defendant sitting here, you know, the life you've lived, would you want to be a juror on that case? You can ask things like that in every case. But clearly asking, you know, things about race or, you know, gang culture, somebody that might feel strongly about gang culture, very different than an accusation of child molestation, very different than accusation of a white collar fraud. So those questions are going to be super case by case. I just try to remember to show the jury as much of myself as possible. I think it's important for you to be very honest and real and have charisma, and always try to get in ways to tell your client's story when you're doing voir dire. It's not always that easy, because you're given limits as to what you can say and how long you can say it for. So those things are consistent. But honestly, jury selection is hard because human nature... I honestly feel like I have won trials that I thought I lost, and I've lost trials I thought that I won, because human nature is complicated, and I don't always get it right when I'm picking a jury.
I don't think anyone gets that right. That's just called free will.
It's a mystery to me sometimes when I ask a jury after, no matter what it is, I try to talk to my jury after, like whether I came in first or second. I like to hear why, and it blows my mind the things that juries focus on. Often, like, not in a good way, like something I didn't even argue or something I didn't focus on. I'm like, why the hell did you spend all the time on that irrelevant, but it doesn't matter because they did what they did. But point being, it's
can
a
you
bit
tell
of
me?
Shoot.
Can you say what's one of the strangest things that you've been like? That's what you were focusing on.
I'm trying to think. I got nothing. I can't think of a specific example, but I'll let you know if one comes up.
Okay. Anything that you would tell your younger self?
Ooh. Be relentless. I think the best skill that I have, it has nothing to do with being smart. It's not even really about being prepared. It's about not giving up. It's seriously, you have to be a complete relentless pain in the ass. So I have this little law firm motto that I came up with when I was in my late 20s that people kind of make fun of, but I like it, okay? I still like it. I haven't changed it, and I'm into alliteration. So if you looked at my law firm site, and I'm not trying to just pitch it here, but it's persistent, passionate, and principled. And I think those are important qualities. Okay, all right, stop laughing.
No, I was trying to find a moment to be like, and you can find this at
www.klgcriminaldefense.com. But my point was not a shameless plug. I really think the best, you know, the best advice I can give myself is to be relentless, because that's what has gotten me the farthest. It's really not about your brains or your preparation, although preparation's important. It's about not giving up. I can't tell you how many times I've been told by a prosecutor, or I've been told by other defense lawyers, you're never going to win that motion, or that judge is never going to go for that, or you doubt yourself. And yeah, of course, most of the time they're right, okay? We lose a lot of the time. We're defense lawyers. But you need to be particularly relentless for this profession. And I think I'd remind myself of that, because sometimes that just feels so damn hard.
What is the rate? What constitutes a loss?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, because I think clients would differ about this. So in my mind, both, you know, a not guilty is an obvious win, right? Mm-hmm. Your client gets acquitted, they go home, they don't go to prison, they don't register as a sex offender, nothing, right? Very often, though, a hung jury can be a win for the defense, because it means that you cracked something in the government's case, whether it's state or federal, and maybe that opens up a dismissal of the charges and like a plea negotiation for something more favorable, or maybe they don't re-pursue their case. Either way, you persuaded some members of the jury that your client wasn't guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. So that, in my mind, is always a win. Some clients, the thought of having to go through that jury trial again or any part of the process doesn't feel like a win. But when I read statistically, it's something like under 10% of the time that happens. So in my mind, that's always a win. But on the more subtle, kind of a more subtle answer to that question, is you can win when you get a charge, your client's facing a felony, they're facing sex registration, and you get them like a misdemeanor and no registration. Or it's a white collar case and they're looking at $2 million in restitution, and you get a restitution amount fixed at $50,000 and they get a misdemeanor instead of a felony and they were facing 20 felonies. So there's a lot of ways that I feel like good advocacy gets you a win that doesn't mean you went to trial and got a not guilty. Because the truth is, most cases don't go to trial. Now, I am a trial attorney. That is what I call myself. And I think I go to trial more than a lot of other private attorneys. But that still is not the majority of my cases. A majority of cases result in plea bargains of some kind. Hmm.
If something is a mistrial, how often does that go back to court?
In the cases I handle, it's almost always. And that's because the majority of the cases I'm going to trial on, the client is facing life imprisonment, so they're not inclined to just give up. However, if you do a lot of misdemeanor work, if you get a hung jury on a misdemeanor, a lot of times they're just going to dismiss and not refile. So it does depend kind of – I don't even want to make that sexist. Like, I'm with the big boys or – screw that. But – there is a difference between felonies and misdemeanors and how much importance the prosecuting agency attaches to that case. And I think the chance of having a case where your client is facing life imprisonment or like a serious period of imprisonment, there's a really high chance if you get a hung jury or a mistrial, as you called it, which is accurate, there's a really strong chance it gets refiled. Whereas with misdemeanors, the few times, and I don't handle that many misdemeanors anymore, where I've gotten them dismissed, or I should say when I've gotten a hung jury, they didn't get refiled.
Since, as you say, you deal with a lot of high stress types of cases and workload, what do you do to de-stress?
It's called alcohol, Michelle.
So the traditional lawyer.
Yeah, I know. That's such a stereotype. No, that's not the only thing. honestly, that's the first thing that came to mind, because the truth is, whether you win a case or lose a case, probably at the conclusion of my jury trial, I will be having a drink and talking about it obsessively, probably with you, but also possibly with my lawyer husbands. But I think for me, working out is really important to calm me down. Dance, workout, those things calm my mind. I'm not great at meditation. I'm not good at calming the mind in other ways. But if I can make myself so tired from my workout that I can't think anymore, that works. And then there's alcohol.
So 0 to 60 and back to zero again. Got it.
Correct.
If you weren't a lawyer, what do you think you would be doing?
Ooh. I mean, the easy answer is that I'd be an actress, but that would never work out, because then I'd have to take direction from other people, and I don't do that very well.
It's important to know thyself in this life.
I honestly think maybe a writer. I mean, I definitely consider myself – I do quite a bit of writing, but it's within, like, you know, legal pleading, you know, paper, and within certain restrictions and motions. Maybe some kind of creative writer. I feel like there's a lot of stories inside me, and right now I'm just telling the stories of my clients because that's my job and that's what I need to do. But at least in like the fantasy world, I think that that would actually be a great profession.
What would you say is the importance of where you go, and what type of degrees that you get in your like, undergrad or even internships?
Well, I think I come from like that New York Jewish, you know, heavy emphasis on education. So it's unfathomable to me, although I've realized there is like a modern narrative that, you know, college is too expensive and not worth it. I just know that I wouldn't be the person I am today without both my boarding school, my Georgetown undergrad, and my Georgetown law. That being said, you know, law school, in my mind specifically, teaches you like a framework for how to analyze legal questions. It certainly doesn't teach you how to be a good lawyer, but it gives you basic training and skills. And it gave me confidence so that when I graduated, I felt like I was ready to go. Like I knew that it was a certain caliber and that it was rigorous training. And I had done a clinic where you actually get clients. And I actually did a domestic violence clinic, which means I was representing victims of domestic violence in court as a law student. And so that gave me practical experience. So then I felt like that training really gave me the confidence to pass the bar, first of all, which I did the first time, which is thankfully, that doesn't happen for everyone. And then to just go and start practicing. And I think, you know, if you don't, of course, if you, you know, if you did more of an online degree or even maybe not as prestigious university, you're not going to feel, you're not going to have as good training. You're not going to feel that confidence level to go out and actually get your own clients and do it. You know, not to say, yeah, of course, I'm a bit of a snob. All right. I'm a bit of an educational snob. I'm not saying everybody has to go to Georgetown. Okay. That wasn't the moral of that story. But I have to say, because of the training I got, I did pass the bar the first time. I did get a job right out of law school at a private law firm. And then I had the confidence to go out on my own. And I just don't think I would have had those tools to me available to me if I didn't have some of the prestige of that. I think in terms of the other question, does it make a difference like where you go? I think it's more makes a difference when you're a corporate lawyer.
What would you tell somebody who's just starting out in law?
But I'm gonna say something funny, but I mean this very seriously. You do not be a swinging dick in court. Okay, so what I mean by that is this.
Karenism.
Yeah. Men tend to have this syndrome. I call it the swinging dick syndrome more than the women. Meaning like, I'm just going to wing it. It's fine. You know, maybe they don't write out their – first of all, you're really supposed to, for the most part, have noticed motions. Meaning like you put them in writing, you set a date, and you go in. Some people feel, particularly men, like they can just walk into court and do motions. But even if you've prepared your motion – you should never wing anything. Like someone's life is in your hands. Have a little goddamn respect. So I think you cannot be overprepared. I literally do not think you can overprepare. I have heard somebody say before to young lawyers, like, you know, don't cram your brain too full, or like, don't, you know, I don't know, look up the law too much the night before. I think that's all bullshit. The truth is, things happen in litigation and in trial and in court you don't expect. So you, if you have relentlessly gone through your facts, the law, your jury instructions, your motion, your best cases, then if something unexpected comes up, you're just prepared because it's in your brain. It's just natural. You've got it. You get the answers. So the swinging dick syndrome is basically having the confidence of a middle-aged mediocre white man and walking into court and just thinking you can do it, right? Don't be a middle-aged white man. That's the moral of that story. But the truth is, I don't think you can over-prepare, and I think it's okay to be neurotic about it. Like, I still write out my cross-examination questions. I do not read them, but this is very old school. This is, like, not a thing. I realize most lawyers, not everyone has to do this. But I bullet point and outline. I have, like, all caps at the top, which is the topic that I don't want to forget. And then I have specific points, and then I have references in, like, police reports or a transcript if I need to question them about that. But I write it all out, not because I'm going to read it when I'm actually in court. That would be terrible. But because it helps me prepare and process. And so I just think that younger lawyers sometimes don't have good role models. Like, I do see a lot of unprepared attorneys in court. And I think that's such an injustice to your client, particularly when literally their life is in your hands. Mm-hmm. Again, very long-winded.
One thing I've always admired about you is your level of confidence, and I think it's served you well in this life. What is one thing that will knock you off of that, and how do you get it back?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I do think I'm a Leo, first of all. So, like, we are born leaders, and we're really humble.
Very humble.
But the truth is, I have that – they call it imposter syndrome, right? It's an actual psychological thing, and I think women have it more than men, honestly, professionally. Yeah. I do. I doubt myself a lot. I don't think there's one particular thing that sort of knocks me off my game. But I will say that there's a general trend in the federal system that can be a bit unnerving. And I always have to take a step back and just remind myself this is not different than how you fight any other case. This is literally you being the underdog. Go get it. But very often on federal cases, they will put three prosecutors against you in trial. So it's like definitely the David and Goliath situation. And so, yes, optically, sometimes you can feel like you're getting sandbagged because you know there's just more people to write motions. There's more people to spread out witnesses. Like, the government has these unlimited resources where they have like an IT department and they have like somebody who does all the PowerPoint for them. And like, I'm me, myself, and I do work with other attorneys, but that can feel incredibly intimidating. But it reminds me that it's sort of like small and mighty, and that you might have to fight harder, but it also makes the win sweeter. Mm-hmm. And frankly, people can underestimate you because of that. And so as long as you can kind of use that as a secret weapon and not let it turn you into like a tailspin, then you can use it to your benefit. But frankly, just having a lot of government resources on the other side, and often three prosecutors against you, yourself, and you, that definitely always takes a second, takes a deep breath, and then you fight like hell, or you go down in flames burning.
Or you go down with a ship. Do you still get underestimated, do you think?
Oh, all the time. So this is all verbal, so you guys can't see what I look like. But I have had clients and prosecutors recently ask me if I'm in my late 20s, which is great. Thank you. Thanks. But I do. I think I get underestimated more often by male lawyers who haven't worked with me. I think if you've worked with me, you know what I'm like. And the second I open my mouth, you can tell I am not a new lawyer. Like, I do think that's true. But I think if you just look at me from afar and you don't know who I am, and older males, man, it's again, the confidence of the middle-aged white man. It's unending. But I do, and I used to get really upset when I was younger and just be so offended because it is also very sexist. I don't.
It's insulting.
It totally is. But, you know, I can't tell you how many times, like, oh, a cop. Cops are really bad. So if it's like an older detective, not women. Women are smart. Like, homicide detectives that are women, they know. They know because a lot of them are sort of young-ish. They can be attractive and really smart and on point. They don't underestimate other women. But, like, male cops, they don't even know what hit them sometimes. Like, I'll chat with them outside the courtroom, and I'll be really nice, off the record. And then I'll cross-examine them and just destroy them. And they're just like, what the hell happened? Because they underestimated me because they're sexist. But it's really fun when that happens now. It's like a really, really, really good moment.
So now you just relish in that moment.
I do.
Got it. So what would you say is one of your more proud or proudest moments in your career, or although you could open it up to your life as well?
Yeah, life. I'm going to give you a non-answer answer, which is what we do as lawyers.
Such an attorney.
You're welcome. So without giving names, because I think it's kind of sensitive, but a lot of times I would say when I feel the proudest in my career, it's some of the smaller moments. Clearly, the not guilty thing is like there's no feeling that can explain like when a jury – when the head of the jury reads that, when the foreperson – I can't believe I just said the head of the jury. When the foreperson reads the verdict and it's not guilty, that's like an indescribable moment. I've definitely had tears. You know, you hug your client. But like sometimes it's the smaller, more subtle moments that really last with me. I'm thinking of one case in particular, and actually one just came to me as I was talking that I'm going to say instead of the ones I was originally thinking of. But this particular woman's story really resonated with me, and I don't think I'll ever forget it because I do think the result in that case literally saved her life, and I'll never forget it. So without giving, you know, names or anything, she was charged in a large RICO conspiracy, and she had severe mental health issues, and she had a really sad history of service to our country, but also being sexually assaulted during that time, among other things that happened. There was a cultural aspect to the case of not counting in the culture in which she was raised because she was a woman. And I had desperately tried to get her into this alternative program, which would be instead of prosecution. And the prosecutor was just so unsympathetic, who incidentally was a woman and who I just found to be so incredibly unreasonable. And I kept trying and trying and trying to get these alternative resolutions, but she was charged with these felony charges just like everybody else in the indictment, and it was a lengthy indictment. And I fought for, I mean, the case took like 5 or 6 years, and I strongly suspected that if she ended up with a prison sentence that she would try to commit suicide. And her therapist even called to warn me the night before sentencing that she thought somebody should be there. And this is somebody who was very fragile, needless to say, but who I really kind of connected to emotionally, like even more so than your typical client, because it's a super smart, really together woman who was totally not together in certain other ways. And I just, something about that was, you know, I connected really well with. And I was in front of a very, very tough judge who is very mercurial is the really nice way of putting it. But like Jekyll and Hyde and crazy is another way of putting it. And on that day, and this wasn't that long ago, so this is like at the beginning of COVID, when the judge came up to me before he officially put it on the record and told me that he was going to give her probation with absolutely no prison time and no other conditions at all. And to tell her, because she looked like she was going to pass out at counsel table because she was so nervous, and I did, and she just started sobbing. And then I got emotional, and I gave her a hug, and I just really feel like the system worked that day. And it's sometimes those small stories that I feel are the proudest career moments, because I just don't know where she would have been if she did get sentenced to prison. And she didn't deserve it, by the way. I should have added that. On top of all the other things, like the allegations in the case in terms of what her participation were in this alleged conspiracy were very minimal, but it was just serious because there was a lot of other people involved and a lot of money involved. And that was like a really important emotional moment for me. And that was one of the most emotional sentencing hearings I've ever done. And pretty much everybody else in that case did go to prison. So, wow.
Jumping back to mental health real quick, how would you say that factors into those who are incarcerated these days?
Well, we definitely have a huge problem with mass incarceration, you know, in the United States at least. And a lot of the people that are being mass incarcerated are people who are just mentally ill. And they have committed crimes, but they don't even understand they're committing crimes. So that's certainly a problem. I will say the district attorney's office in LA has theoretically developed a program that's supposed to be like a mental health diversion. The problem is they're not implementing it frequently. Mm-hmm. And you have to really fight tooth and nail to get it. I'd say mental health is a factor in a majority of my cases. I would say it's not every case, right? But a lot of people end up, you know, the good people that make bad decisions, you know, there's a mental health issue there. And maybe it's a temporary one. Maybe it's something that's triggered by something very difficult that's happened in life. Like, for example, this is a couple of my cases, seeing your father shot in front of you when you're very young in gang territory.
Oh, God.
I can't even imagine the trauma that causes, right?
Yeah.
And people think PTSD is a made-up thing. It is not. I think mental health is a part of a majority of my cases, but not all. And I think we're getting better at how we address that in the criminal justice system, but we're definitely not there yet. It's funny. I thought you were going to ask about my mental health, but you did not.
We already have all of the questions about your mental health. I'm just kidding.
So much to unpack there.
I do hang out with you kind of frequently. So if there's something wrong with you, it's kind of a guilty by association kind of thing. I'm also.
So you're going to take the fifth?
Yes.
Got it.
My attorney, ladies and gentlemen.
That was super nerdy, by the way, what we just did there.
I know. I never said I was cool. Thank you very, very much for your time. Thank you for sitting with me, answering all my questions, your patience with me. And thank you. You're the best.
Well, you have my number if you need it. No, I really hope you don't ever, other than to go for drinks.
Yeah, no.
You're welcome.
Let's just save that for happy hour, shall we? Let's just keep it there.
We shall.
All right. Ciao, we're done.
That wraps up my conversation with Karen Goldstein. If you want to hear any outtakes or see what's coming up next on the podcast, head over to the Instagram channel, Jack of No Trades Podcast. All updates are there. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Until next time, I'm Michelle McAllister. Thanks for listening.